From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 6 for Friday, December 10th, 2010. Hi there, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in the Wired Hive today is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And our news editor, Olivia Solon.
Hello.
And very special guest today, Jack Dyson, senior copywriter for Wired Magazine.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm incredibly good, even though I'm technically on holiday right now. But we are looking, what's the word to describe us today?
Hot.
Beastly.
Sexy.
I'm certainly feeling hot.
You're certainly feeling dinosaur. Like, we are in the Christmas spirit. We're wearing, we're all wearing Kigu animal costumes because we thought it'd be a laugh since this is one of the last times we'll all be together before the Christmas break.
Is that in the Christmas spirit, wearing animal costumes?
No.
Is that a Christmassy thing that I just don't know about?
We don't do it any other time of the year. I mean, Duncan's dressed as a giant giraffe. Jack is dressed as a dinosaur. Olivia is dressed as, what are you, a kangaroo?
A kangaroo.
And you've even got a pouch.
Yeah,
what did I call you that pouch yesterday?
What?
I said something, I called that pouch something.
Baby pocket?
No, it was something. I called it something. It was really, really weird.
Is it okay? Safe for podcast?
It might not have been, actually. But you do have a little baby beaver or something in there.
What is it? I'm a kangaroo. It's kangaroo. A baby kangaroo,
okay.
Obviously.
Whatever. Okay, and I'm dressed as a giant cat.
Yes.
Have I got my head up? Yeah. So
can
we're all
can
in.
Can you give us a meow?
No. Maybe later. Maybe after Christmas. Yeah, we'll put a photo on the website or something. We just took a quite amusing photo. We thought it'd be fun. And it is fun. So we've got so much news today. We're not going to have a main feature, but I suspect this will involve a lot of discussion. Google has launched, quite a bunch of things, actually, but it's launched an ebook store. Google has got into the paid-for ebook market and has vowed to sell 3 million books and compete with the likes of Amazon and Barnes & Noble in the US. And although this is a US launch at the moment, it's going to be coming to the UK, we expect, next year. Duncan, you're not as excited about this as I am. I think this is a massive, massive deal for Google. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, as you say, it's been a very, very busy week for Google. And this, of all the announcements, some of which we're going to talk about in a minute, is probably the one I'm least excited about overall, mainly for the reasons that we were discussing in a previous podcast about how ebooks are rubbish.
There is that. But I mean, this is a bit different because, I mean, the problem with ebooks before now is that they, as we've discussed, they're kind of always tied to a piece of hardware or a couple of pieces of hardware, something like that. What Google's saying it wants to do is have an ebook reader that is essentially, I say web-based, it's sort of browser.
It's a web store.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to be compatible with the iPod, the iPad. It's going to be on Android devices, obviously. It's going to be on any PC, a web browser that supports JavaScript. It's even going to be on the Kindle and the Sony readers, thanks to Adobe's DRM system. And so it's going to be...
it's not on one, isn't it? There's one that it doesn't work on, which is the...
I'm not sure, but it's on the Nook. I know it's on the Nook in the US. We don't have that here.
Is it the Kindle?
No, it's on the Kindle.
Works?
Yeah, it's on the Kindle.
I'm sure there's one that it doesn't work with. But anyway, that's not really the point. I think the point for me is that it's still stuff with DRM, you know? It's still got the same...
If the publishers want.
Well, that's the thing. The publishers do want. It's very much the fault of the publishers, all of the mess that ebooks is in. Well, I can't see how Google is going to have any more luck against that than, say, Amazon, which has had a working relationship with the publishers for far, far longer than Google has.
It has, but Google's got a massive pull, and this is one of the reasons I think this is such huge news, because, I mean, this is Google. Google has been scanning millions of books for the last 6 years, and since about 2004 it started scanning out of copyright works in the US and is now making those available as part of this system. And 2.8 million of these 3 million books are out of copyright works that it's been scanning from university libraries and things like that. And it's going to be selling books from anything from a dollar, which is about 69-70p, up to almost £200, I think, $300, something like that, because a lot of these are kind of technical manuals as well.
I don't know, for me the issue is, because a lot of the fuss about it has kind of, about Google's and their ebook ambitions has focused around these so-called orphan books, where they're out of print and they can't find the copyright holder, you know, whoever owns the copyright on it is, you know, it's been lost over the period of time. And, you know, Google obviously wants to put these out, but all of the publishers are saying, no, you're not going to do that.
Well, that's the thing. All the publishers, the major publishers in the US have signed on. They're going to be a part of this. They've got a revenue splitting deal where I think it's sort of half and half each. I think Google's going to be getting these at the kind of, you know, trade rate that other sites get them for and split the cost. And
my point is that the one thing that would put Google aside, apart from all of the other ebook stores, is these orphan works, and yeah, they're not in the bookstore to begin with, at the very least.
But that's because there's a court case going on at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Google said that they'd make all these books available for Amazon to have access to as well, not just, you know, them holding on to it themselves, but it's currently in court, so they can't actually release them until that's been settled.
Yeah, Amazon filed a complaint in a US court and basically said that this gives Google an unfair advantage because, you know, Amazon hasn't been able to go around and scan all these books. But I sort of think, well, so what? Google has said you can use these too. So I'm not quite sure whether
Amazon,
or not this will stand.
Nothing was preventing Amazon from doing that.
No one was preventing Amazon from doing that. And I think if Google was saying, we've scanned all these works and now we're not going to give them to anyone else to use, that would be very, very different. Because obviously Google doesn't own these books. All Google does is own the scans and they can't claim ownership of the actual text. There's a knock-on effect to this, which is that obviously at the moment, as we mentioned earlier, this is US only. It's going to be coming to the UK hopefully later in the year. But, next year. You can read books from outside the US. So if you buy one of these books in the US and you go overseas, you can still read the books you've bought. However, if you read one of these books that is not out of copyright in, say, the UK, you won't be able to read that book in the UK, even though you can read it in the US, purely because Google hasn't been able to say, well, it's out of copyright in the UK, so therefore we're allowed to give it to you. And I think, how are you keeping track of every single book and its copyright status in all these different countries? It seems like an absolute minefield of problems.
I'm sure it is. It's going to be a big ass database, and you know.
What's interesting to me is if you look at the way the music, the PRS in music, the Royalties Collection Service, has been, you know, put in quite a lot of jeopardy by the negotiation with music rights. Is that going to happen with books? And are Google effectively putting themselves forwards as the next royalties collection agency? Or in fact, I mean, is it any surprise that the book publishers, having seen what happened in the music industry, have all jumped on board and said, you know what, we're not going to miss this boat, let's get on it.
Well,
at least make sure we can steer it.
I think that there's a problem there, which is simply that, you know, they, as you say, they've seen what happened with music, they're seeing what's happening with movies and TV shows, and to a certain extent games as well. And like you say, they don't want to miss the boat this time, but they're still, you know, they're still insistent on things like DRM. We've seen this system in the US where, I think it's on the Kindle or the Nook, you can lend someone a digital copy of your book, but when they've got it, your digital copy becomes unreadable, you know, which obviously makes sense if it's a complete analog to books, but it doesn't work for the digital world. And so I see them making the same mistakes again, even though they're getting on board with it.
I don't see that they've learned any lessons whatsoever. You know, if they're still mucking about with these licenses, they're not prepared to reform the licensing, which is what's needed, then I can't see how this, you know, just because it's Google, I can't see how it's going to be especially different from any other ebook store that I'm completely unexcited about.
Well, one thing that I am quite excited about is you know, going back in time many years to when I was a student, this would have been amazing for me because it would have given me access, I would hope, to a lot of reading material.
Yeah.
And, you know, around the world that does have enormous repercussions.
I think this is a really, really big deal. I mean, one of the reasons I think it's such a big deal is purely because it's Google. Google has a hell of a lot of money. It's been spending, you know, millions of dollars in investing in scanning these books and making them available to everyone. I don't think Google wants to be in a similar position to PRS for books. I don't think it wants to be licensing books. I don't think it's legally in a position to even be able to suggest it could do that.
And I don't think the publishers would want them to do that.
They certainly wouldn't want them to do that. I think Google basically just wants to be doing sort of what it's always been doing, which is making information accessible to everyone. And that means that it can, you know, I mean, it is a business, it's not a non-profit, it's not like the Internet Archive, for example, that archives web pages and books and things like that. It's a business, and they've got to be very careful how they approach it. But I still think this could be one of the biggest moves in digital books since Amazon released the Kindle. I really, really do.
Didn't they also, a year or so ago, reveal a kind of machine that you could have within in bookstores that would print off something from Google Books then and there? So a bookstore could basically technically have every single book ever written in stock without having to obviously stock it physically and order it in.
Yeah,
and then you could print to order on a quite expensive machine, but it would print to order any book that you'd want, and you'd obviously give the bookstore owner, for those who aren't interested in ebooks or e-readers, could actually get a physical copy of the book. Which
yeah, there's been a few of these sort of print-on-demand systems that Google itself doesn't operate them, but a few companies make them, and it's a lot of this has been set up for Amazon as well, which does this kind of print-on-demand, so you can print your own books as well. And there's a site, I think it's Lulu, and I'm not sure if Amazon bought
Blurb do that Lulu, as well.
But I think they bought a similar company.
But this was actually a machine that you'd have in the bookstore, which would print one single copy of a book off, as opposed to a kind of, you know, big self-publishing company.
It's an early step, isn't it? But I'm excited about it. But there's been some other interesting Google news this week. One is that the new version of Android, the mobile OS, came out, which is Android 2.3 Gingerbread.
Well, the SDK is out.
Yeah, well, I think the OS is out on a new phone.
I don't think you can buy it quite yet. It'll be out in about a week or so.
Oh, is it a week? Okay,
I think so. It's not far off.
Yeah, it's very, very close. So people are going to be able to start getting this on their phones, I think, relatively soon. Is that right?
It's going to come to Nexus Ones in... I asked Google about this the other day, and they told me in a couple of weeks, probably. They haven't got an exact date because they don't want to give one because they might miss it, and you know.
And people with things like the HTC, the Hero, and the Magic, and things like that, they're going to get it down the line.
Less likely. I mean, if you've got any phone other than the Nexus One, then whether you get the update or not will depend very much on the people who make your phone. So it'll depend on Samsung or on HTC or whatever, because each manufacturer tends to apply these sort of skins over the top of Android. HTC has Sense, Samsung has TouchWiz, and so on. Motorola has MotoBlur,
Isn't just Android,
Sony has one. And so what they've got to do with all of these things is update those so that they make sure that they work 100% with the new update. And that's why on so many phones, the Android updates get delayed for so long.
And I mean, what's the big selling point for Android 2.3? Should people be excited about waiting for it for their Hero or whatever?
Not as much, maybe, as some past updates have been. It does come with a really nice UI overhaul, so it looks really pretty and different. There's a slightly different launcher. It's a bit faster in different ways. It has support for new types of sensors, so it can now support gyroscopes and also, really, really interestingly, near-field communications, where you just sort of, you might have seen them in shops like Visa PayWave and things like that. You just swipe your phone over this sort of point.
It's a bit like
we'll be able to exchange identification. Stuff, yeah. Yeah, it's a bit like RFID, but a little bit more complex.
So it sounds more like that. What the software is doing is it's enabling the next generation of Android phones themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
So we could see a time where maybe you could incorporate an Oyster card reader inside a phone.
Yeah,
so you
that's.
Could just, I mean, we've seen trials with that actually before in London. Well, I know
in Japan, that's what
we and in Japan, I think they use it. Everywhere. Yeah, and we've I've definitely seen those trialed.
I mean, it's kind of possible to do that at the moment if you chop out the right bit of your Oyster card and stick it in the back cover of your phone. But you know, that's kind of different.
I just stick mine in my Angry Birds iPhone case in the back. It slots in quite nice.
But then you'd want to top it up by your phone as well.
You would, and that's probably going to be possible soon as well.
But far more exciting than 2.3 was that Google whipped out, and it sounds from what people have been telling me is as if this wasn't really actually planned. He just decided to do it. This is Andy Rubin, who I think it was Andy Rubin, who runs Android. He pretty much is the big boss of Android. And on stage at a conference, he pulled out a tablet, a Motorola Concept tablet that's running Android 3.0 Honeycomb. And that's a bit more special.
But this is one that's basically just for tablets, isn't it?
No, not specifically. I mean, it's designed with tablets in mind, okay? It's the first version of Android that's been built with support for tablets, you know. Android has always supported tablets, but it's always been a very secondary thing to mobile phones. Honeycomb will be the first one that comes with an interface that's designed for tablets.
Is this going to kill the iPad? Or the Samsung Galaxy Tab?
The Samsung Galaxy Tab won't kill the iPad, even though they've sold a million of them, which really impressed me, because I wasn't that impressed with it.
I'm impressed. They've been advertising everywhere, though. Jack, what do you think about tablets? Just as a slight aside, as a dinosaur.
As a dinosaur, I can say quite safely that on the train the other day, I saw my first non iPad pad user.
Really?
Yeah, and it was a guy who looked not as cool as someone with an iPad.
And it's, do you know what pad was it?
It was the Samsung one, I think.
Samsung, the Galaxy. It's a lot smaller.
Isn't it smaller, and he was sitting there and making very deft movements like a conductor with his finger or stylus or whatever he was using. I can't remember. And I was with a girlfriend, and we were looking at him and agreed basically I'd rather look a bit like a flash git and have something that was nicer than look like someone who still doesn't have something that's quite as cool. Aww. Just on principle. And it's quite sad that. But I just don't think they are as good looking yet. And because of that, because it's largely a lifestyle thing, then the other guys have got a bit of catching up to do on that front alone.
Well, other things that are lifestyles and life choices, Chrome OS, the very last Google story. It's been a very Google-heavy week, actually, hasn't it?
It has. Yeah. Well, they've just done three big launches. Yeah.
And so the Chrome OS, tell us, Duncan, as Mr. Google, what's good about Chrome OS? Why is it interesting? And it's the App Store.
It's really interesting because it's an operating system, so it'll replace Windows or OS X on your computer, or Linux if you like to run Linux, but then you probably know what an OS is already, with a different operating system called Chrome OS, which is pretty much just a browser and nothing else.
I mean, Chrome OS has been around for a while in terms of I've known about it for about 18 months.
Yeah, it's been in development for a long, 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 long time. Mm. And the launch this week is just a kind of launch. You know, it was them saying, yes, you know, this is something that we are seriously doing. We're going to be launching a notebook with it, a bit like they launched the Nexus One phone. There's going to be a Chrome OS netbook.
It's going to have an actual Google.
There'll be a
Google netbook.
Yeah, exactly. And that looks quite interesting. At the moment, it's still very much a development platform. It's still a bit rusty around the edges, and it's so stripped back. But the much more interesting thing that came alongside it was the Chrome Web Store, which is part of Google's move from desktop applications or laptop applications over to web applications. So you do things like photo editing or other things like that in a web browser.
Why would you want to? Why would you want to? Why web browsers aren't yet as capable as a desktop app?
Well, that's the point. They actually are. With HTML5 and, you know, recent improvements with plugins and things like that, you can pretty much do most stuff in a web browser that you'd want to do on your desktop.
I can't use Photoshop CS5 in a web browser. Until you can get something as capable as Adobe CS5 or video editors or things like that, it's never going to replace a desktop app.
Have you tried, I think it's called Aviary, which is on the Chrome Web App Store?
I haven't yet, no.
Give it a go, because I haven't tried it myself yet, but I've heard people saying that it does the vast majority of stuff you'd want to do, the average user would want to do in Photoshop. Maybe not, you know, professional graphic designers and stuff like that, but it's free, it's in the browser, you don't have to download so much stuff. It looks pretty good.
Liv, are you excited about having an app store in a web browser?
I think so, yeah. I'm quite a Google fan as well, and I think the idea of having everything in the clouds is quite good for me, because especially as my machines have a habit of packing up on me and dying, and I don't back stuff up. So the thought of storing it all on the web is a good idea for me.
Very well. I just had the idea. You could store an iPad or a tablet in that pouch of yours.
The beaver pouch.
Okay, that's, I think,
stop talking about my beaver pouch.
I'm sorry, I think that's enough talk about Google as well for today. We probably talked about that as long as if we'd have done Google as a feature, so there you go, bonus feature you weren't expecting, and neither were we. In some science news, Japan, the Japanese space agency, I'm not sure the exact name, Akatsuki probe was supposed to go to enter Venus's orbit do some tests on its atmosphere, and it wanted to monitor its volcanic activity and provide some conclusive proof that the planet had lightning. And it cost about £190 million, 25 billion yen. And unfortunately, it has sort of missed Venus's orbit and is Japan's, I don't know how many failed attempts this is now, but I know that its last probe was supposed to go to Mars, I think, and that crashed or got lost. And poor Japan. Japan has no luck going to.
I think it's rather sad because you've got a collection of scientists who devote several years to putting something up. It takes 5 years for it to get there after you've managed to build the thing, and then you're all sitting there really excited. You've got the champagne on ice, and you're in the control room, and you've done the whole Houston, this is Texas stuff, and then it just misses orbit completely.
It's such a shame. I think the last failure was in 2003, and the same agency had plans to orbit Mars. And about 5 years into its mission, it was off target and it missed the planet entirely. And it means that Japan has never actually succeeded at an interplanetary mission, which seems really surprising considering, you know, how forward Japan is with technology. You would have sort of assumed that they'd be putting men on Pluto, but no, well, men couldn't go on Pluto for obvious reasons.
But the other thing is that if it takes 5 years to get there, it arrives there with, you know, pretty much second-rate technology, because I think this one's got infrared cameras and a couple of other bits and bobs, which now we've got on our phones anyway. So
it's a bit like an aeroplane. You get on a brand new aeroplane and it's got media systems from 6 years ago, because that's when they were designed.
Exactly.
Instead
exactly.
of when they were built. Fair enough. In slightly less science-heavy news, something funny on Ubisoft. Ubisoft, the game publisher, has... It seems to me that Ubisoft is the most annoying when it comes to digital rights management on games.
I don't buy Ubisoft games for exactly that reason.
Really?
I refuse to, yeah.
I mean, there was the whole uproar, I think, with, was it Assassin's Creed, where you couldn't play it unless you were connected to the internet? And if
you lost your web connection at any point, it would boot you out of the single-player game, and you'd lose all the progress you'd made since it was last saved. It was utterly ridiculous, horrible for, you know, the people who've paid for the game.
Well, now what they're doing is, as an anti-piracy measure, on the Nintendo DS version of the new Michael Jackson, The Experience game. Any copied versions of the game will make the game unplayable because players will be taunted with the sound of vuvuzelas, which was the sort of beehive-like noise that plagued the recent football. Was it the World Cup? I don't know. I am so out of touch with football. I can't even remember if it was the World Cup or not.
I think at least they're taking... I think it's quite... I know it is very irritating, but I think at least they've taken a creative approach to DRM. And
it's a bit lighthearted.
It's lighthearted. And what they do, you know, they've coded it so the software checks to see whether it's running on a legitimate DS cartridge. And if it realises it's on a copied cartridge, it will prevent you from playing and just play these really annoying sounds over the top of it.
It's just absolutely amazing. And there's a quote that we got from Ubisoft, who said the development team worked this feature in as a creative way to discourage any tampering with the retail version of the game.
I think that's good. It's almost like a little Easter egg. I think it's a better approach than just having some kind of lame message come up.
I'm not encouraging piracy or anything like that, and anti-piracy measures are there for a reason. It just kind of bugs me that it's Ubisoft again doing something, going the next step. You know, I'm sure the game's great, and Assassin's Creed was great, but the DRM, seriously,
is Michael WTF Jackson LOL. The experience? I don't know if it's going to be that great.
No, well, I guess not. Other things that could be great, though. Duncan, you wrote a really interesting story earlier this week about the tooth decay enzyme being identified, and well, explain what's all that about.
Well, this is potentially quite interesting. There's a pair of researchers from the Netherlands. Has one of you got the names on hand?
I do. They're very
very Dutch.
I don't know how to pronounce them. Bouk Dijkstra and Lubert Dijkhuizen.
That was amazing.
We're very sorry if either of you are listening.
Spoken, may I say, like a kangaroo.
I'm really sorry about that.
Anyway, they've managed to identify. Thank you very much. They've managed to identify exactly the enzyme that's responsible for plaque sticking to your teeth, and what they're hoping to do is then be able to identify substances that are going to inhibit it, so that we may genuinely be able to get rid of tooth decay within our lifetimes. It's
Is that true, though? Because, I mean, this is very, very much... We have identified what makes plaque stick to teeth. That's a very, very different thing to saying we have gotten rid of plaque and we have stopped tooth decay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very much kind of a far out, that's the end goal, possibly.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
In a million years.
I mean, the difficulty comes because the particular enzyme is a very, very, very close copy... Mm-hmm. of another enzyme that helps break down starch into sugar in your gut, in your saliva, sorry, rather than in your gut. So far, all of the inhibitors that they've tested have stopped that from functioning, as well as the plaque enzyme.
I see. So it's kind of like saying, well, we can cut fuel emissions completely across the world, and we can stop cars producing exhaust, but it does also mean we don't have petrol, so the cars won't work anyway.
Yes,
it's that
exactly.
sort of yeah, catch 22.
Exactly. And so they've got to look further. They're basically going to need a very, very, very targeted inhibitor for this to work out for them. But if they can find that, mm-hmm. then you could start putting that into toothpaste or into mouthwash. Or yeah, exactly. They suggest you could even put it into sweets. So you'd end up eating sweets to stop tooth decay.
You know, I love the thought that we're sat here dressed as cats, dinosaurs, kangaroos and giraffes. And we're talking about putting stuff into our Haribo so we don't have to brush our teeth anymore. I think we've just regressed our age by a good 15 years.
We're living the dream.
It is the dream. Yeah. It is quite literally a dream to eat Haribo all day and it'd be good for you. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm fairly excited by that. I think it sounds quite interesting.
Well, I mean, you'd still get a sugar rush from it or not. If they're breaking it down, if they, you know.
Yeah, I think you would, because all that the enzyme does is it turns bits of the sugar, the glucose bits, it attaches them into these long chains, which then stick to your teeth.
I reckon the conspiracy amongst dentists will prevent this from ever becoming something viable. I swear, I have no idea whether dentists are doing a job that needs doing or not. Whenever I go, I just hand over huge amounts of money and they drill something out and put something back in, and
it's like going for an operation. You go and you come out with one less organ.
Yeah.
You think, I just paid to get rid of something.
Yeah, was that entirely necessary? Who knows? But you don't want to have toothache, so
yeah, absolutely. And after this year, don't I know it? Well, I think it's interesting. We've got a story up on the website with a lot more detail in there, and do check it out if you're interested in the future of not having plaque on your teeth. And finally, we've got one more story here, which wasn't on Wired, but it was something I read this morning on the Wall Street Journal, which is that Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO and founder of Facebook, has agreed to go the route of Bill Gates and Carl Icahn and Warren Buffett and give away the majority of his wealth to charity in his lifetime, which I find to be absolutely amazing, that basically we're now in this culture where the world's billionaires, and we were looking earlier, is about 1,000 billionaires, something like that, or 1,000 people in the world who have more than $1 billion in wealth, are actually going to be saying, well, I've got all this money, I'm going to do some good with it.
It's obviously too much money.
It is. I mean, Bill Gates has almost $60 billion, you know, to his name, and he is basically giving away the vast majority of that to, you know, curing things like eradicating polio, for example, or not polio, it's
malaria.
Malaria. That's, thank you.
I think it's really interesting that people are looking at a legacy that goes beyond making more money. And I think there's a lot of positive to be had from this story. And, you know, yeah, you can be cynical and say, well, you know, what was he going to do with it anyway? And sort of bob it off. But what's interesting to me is that as well as the fact that Buffett and Gates have been having these dinners where they invite billionaires to take part, uh-huh. they've also had a lot of people say no. And the fact that, how many people have they got? 17?
I think they've got 16 now. It might be 17.
16, 17, something
it's
like
between
that.
15 and 20 billionaires saying we'll give away the majority of our wealth. It's called the Giving Pledge.
So say there's 20 people who are going to give half of a billion each, right? That's 10 billion. Mm. And there are still... 9,090 people left, 990 people who are left who haven't agreed to do this.
But this is the first time this has ever been done, you know, and the great thing about this, I think as Duncan pointed out earlier in a way, Duncan's looking very cynical right now.
No, it's just,
go on. Yeah, exactly. There's always been philanthropists. This isn't the first time it's been done. People have always given to charity.
That's not quite what I mean. What I mean is this is the first time that these billionaires have actually set up actual pledges that says, I will do this. In my lifetime, I will give away the majority of my money. People have always given money to charity. It's always been something they've done. That's not what I mean. But this is, from what I know, the first time that we've had a situation like this.
When we've got
26-year-old, yeah, exactly, like an actual organised, I will sign on to do this sort of thing.
I'm still a bit sceptical of that. But well, I mean,
I think the scale of it is pretty unprecedented, and the fact that there's so many, you know, there's agreements between these people that sets it apart.
Yeah, plus, do you really want to piss off Bill Gates by saying when you're 26, I'll give away my money, and then when you're 50, you become, you know, kind of selfish and decide that you're going to be Scrooge. Like, it's Christmas. Give a few billion.
Yeah.
The thing is that's different from before is there's probably more billionaires today than there ever has been, or certainly in the last 5 years there has been more than there ever has been. You know, people have got more money than ever before.
Well, the impression money is... I get is that the billionaires, to sort of give them a grouping, who have agreed to do this, are all obviously very successful businessmen. And if they take on a problem like malaria... instead of sort of getting bogged down in NGO status and faffing around in field things, they're going to take the same approach they took to building their international printers business or whatever and apply it to a world problem. And yeah, I'm a bit sort of starry-eyed about it, but that's because I think it's a really, really good thing. I think it should be encouraged that people leave something behind and actually you know, move on from making money and setting up social networking websites?
Well, I think on that note, we should move on and conclude this rather Google and tech-heavy episode of the Wider Cut UK podcast. If you want to read about any of these stories and more on the website, you can do it, wired.co.uk/news. All of our stories that we've talked about today are there. And if you go to wired.co.uk/podcast, you can see the show notes for this episode, and it's got links to everything we've talked about. And a slight note, we have a competition. If you want to win a copy, pardon me, if you want to win a copy of, what is it?
Adobe
CS5. Yeah, Creative Suite. We're giving away a copy of the full version of Adobe CS5.
You can includes Photoshop and Illustrator and
Adobe Premiere.
Everything Adobe you would probably have heard of.
Yes. If you go to wired.co.uk, you can enter a multiple choice question and see if you can win a copy of CS5. It's pretty good.
I've noticed there's no cat news today, but I assume that you are the cat news.
I am, yeah, I guess.
Because
I'm
because you're dressed as a cat.
I realise that cat news is becoming a bit of a regular thing. I don't want it to be a regular thing. I want to just throw it out there on occasion. And, you know, when there's some great cat news going on in the world, then I'll be reporting it. Don't worry, cat news will not go unreported. If there's something going on with cats, you'll hear about it here
first.
I really wish I had recorded that on video because you're there dressed in a full-on cat suit. It's hilarious.
Well, there will be a photo of us on the website in our Christmas costumes with
your pouch. They're not Christmas costumes. They're any occasion wear.
Oh, trust me. This will be a Christmas costume. I will be wearing this all Christmas.
All Christmas Day.
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, thanks to Kigu for giving us these for a couple of weeks. That'll be quite fun for a photo. Yeah, you can see the photo on the website, in fact. In fact, for this episode, go to... what did I say? wired.co.uk/podcast and find the entry for episode 6 and you'll probably see a photo of us. I'd like to thank you guys for joining us.
Liv, like thank you for hosting.
Thank you. Yeah, that was great.
And to Jack for joining us. Absolute on this, pleasure. The 6th episode of our downloadable radio audio presentation. And you can follow us on Twitter at WiredUK and on Facebook at UK Wired. And we will see you hopefully next week. Bye.
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 Liv,
really pleased for you.
Liv, can you do me some words?
I can do you some words.
Tell me what you had for breakfast this morning.
I'm a kangaroo and I've got a Joey in my pouch.
Wow.